And welcome to another edition of Zoomed In. I'm the host, Brandon Chapman, and I'm joined by two phenomenal individuals, different colleges, but we are all about collaboration here in the College of Education. One of them is Erica Weintraub-Austin, who's from the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication. And Erica, welcome. And then we've got Bruce Austin, who's in the Educational Psychology Program in the College of Education. And I actually am very aware of the research that you have been doing. One of the doctoral students that's been involved in your project, Sean Domgaard, is a personal friend of mine. And so he's been excited about this for a couple of years now and giving me updates and letting me know where you were in the process. And so I think it's fantastic research. I was really happy to find out that this was published. I don't want to talk all about it. I want to let you talk about it. So I guess we'll start, Dr. I'm going to call you Dr. Austin, but that's going to be a problem. So Erica, it'll be Erica and Bruce. We'll just be, we're going to be really chummy here. Erica and
that's
Bruce.
Fine.
Erica, why don't you lead us off? Tell us the publication. What was this published in? And, you know, of course, like any other academic publication, it's got a really long title. So why don't you tell us about that? And then Bruce, at some point, we'll come around to you.
Oh, you'll need to come around to him.
And welcome both of you.
Thank you very much for having us. Yeah, you'll definitely need to get Bruce involved because he's the stats guy who really understands what's going on here.
His mind works on a different level.
Totally does. So we're happily published just this past week in the American Journal of Health Promotion. We're very excited about this. And yes, Sean Domgaard is awesome. We're really excited that he's involved in this process. And the title of our publication is How Media Literacy, Trust of Experts and Flu Vaccine Behaviors Associated with COVID-19 Vaccine Intentions. And this was all about how people were thinking about maybe getting the vaccine before it was available in the beginning of the pandemic.
So when you talk about media literacy, that, of course, is now it all makes sense. Like, how is the Murrow College involved in this? And of course, you can't talk about media literacy without hearing terms now about misinformation, disinformation, fake news, this and that and the other. What is media literacy, basically, and how does that play into this?
Well, when I talk about media literacy, what I'm really talking about is how do people use the media effectively instead of letting the media use them? And there are a lot of people, entities out there who are very happy to take the media and use the media to use you if you'll let them do it. So they'll take the media to use you to sell you something. And they'll sell you a product or an idea or a policy, a political candidate, you know, all kinds of things. And during the pandemic, they were trying to do all of those things, and often all at the same time. And there was a lot of misinformation out there, and people were essentially huddled at home because it was dangerous to, you know, go outside and interact with other people. At the very beginning of the pandemic, people were mostly very, very cooperative about this. And when we started collecting data for a couple of surveys that we had going on in collaboration, the Murrow College in collaboration with education and also with some people out of the College of Medicine, people were really very cooperative. And as time went on, people started getting less cooperative and, you know, very frustrated with everything that was going on. And part of what was happening was there was a lot of misinformation that was out there. People were very uncertain about what was happening, and they were looking for information, trying to understand what was going on and how could they keep themselves safe, how could they keep their families safe, how could they keep their communities safe. And there were a lot of peddlers of false information that were out there. And a lot of, you know, a lot of the misinformation that was out there was based on little pieces of real information that were then, they then packaged little bits of real information with lots of false information. And a lot of the false information was packaged in a way where they could sell you something. They could sell you some products or some political points of view along with that false information. And some of it was packaged very, very persuasively with a lot of emotion attached to it. And people were starting to get persuaded by that stuff. So media literacy is about being able to sort of unpackage that, to be able to figure out what's the accurate stuff and what's the less accurate stuff. And you have to start with, where is it coming from? What's the source? How can you figure out what's a trustworthy source? And how can you figure out where, you know, is it up-to-date information? Is it old? Is it a good source, a trustworthy source? Maybe it's up-to-date information. Maybe it's out-of-date information. Which parts of it can I believe? Which parts of it should I not believe? It's really not very easy to do, especially in a situation like we were in.
Well, and obviously media are made up of various mediums, right? So you have print journalism, you know, newspapers, things of that nature, TV news. Your CNN viewer is not generally the same as your Fox News viewer. Yep. Social media, which is just like the wild, wild west. You know, when I hear you talk about this, Erica, it feels like confirmation bias is a huge issue where we want the information to fit the view that we already have. And I'm not sure that some of the misinformation is necessarily done in poor intent, but we've already conditioned ourselves to want to believe something, and things come in one ear and out one mouth, and we share those Absolutely. Things, and that's how this perpetrates.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you know, the World Health Organization very quickly said that not only was there a pandemic going on, there was an infodemic going on, because there was so much misinformation out there. And there were some studies that were going on about the extent of the misinformation and where it was coming from. And the World Health Organization actually held a conference. They brought together people worldwide to try to, and of course it had to be online, to try to figure out, what are we going to do about this? And they started posting misinformation and then the real information to try to help people sort through the false information and then the real information. So here's the false stuff, here's the real stuff. And as the pandemic was developing, you know, we were getting more information all the time. You know, science is a process of learning, and we're getting new information all the time. We're learning more all the time. And as the pandemic was progressing, we were getting more information all the time. And so actually, as we did this study, what we were trying to find out was, how were people going about learning? How were they going about figuring out what was true, what was not true? Who were they trusting? What sources of information were they learning from? How are they figuring out what sources to trust? What sources should they not trust? You know, what kinds of media entities were they using? What kinds of expert sources, like scientists, World Health Organization, local health experts, and so on? What were they using to trust? What did they know? What kind of misinformation did they believe? How were they figuring this out? And how could we predict whether they were going to decide if they might be willing to get a vaccine once a vaccine would become available? And we had a theoretical model and all this kind of stuff to try to figure that out, based on media, what we know about media literacy and how that might predict all of this stuff. And we thought, based on people's previous behavior about whether they get vaccines, you know, that might be a good head start. You know, if people get a vaccine in the past behavior might predict future behavior. At least it's like a foot in the door. It might help them be a little bit more confident about whether they'd get the next vaccine. It might make them a little bit more open to getting the next vaccine that was just being developed. But it's not a perfect predictor. People are still maybe going to be a little bit skeptical, especially when there was some new technology being developed and they had to go about doing this really quickly. But if they were trusting of experts, of the scientists, of the medical professionals, and maybe of the news coverage about how this was being developed, maybe that would also help them be more willing to take that chance on that new vaccine. And so we were looking at all of this. And so we looked at whether they'd gotten a flu vaccine in the past and how much were they trusting the experts and how media literate were they? How good were they at sorting through the information, testing the sources, testing the content of information in the sources of information they were using, and then sorting through all of that to make a decision about, before the vaccine was available, how willing were they? You know, what was their intent before the vaccine was available, to get that vaccine when it was going to be available? And, you know, that confirmation bias you're talking about, it was really interesting to us, you know, based on their knowledge and their previous behavior, how much was that going to predict their future behavior? And then when you add to that their media literacy and their trust of experts, how much was that going to add to be able to predict their future behavior? What was super fascinating to us was, you know, the United States actually, you know, we hear about vaccine hesitancy all the time and controversies about vaccine hesitancy. But the truth is, in the past, the United States has actually been almost at the top when you look at different countries in terms of people's willingness to get a flu vaccine. The United States has actually been almost at the top of the developed world in people's willingness to get a flu vaccine. So we thought, if people are willing to get a flu vaccine, they should be pretty willing to go get a COVID vaccine. I mean, COVID is so horrendous. If you think about in mid-2020, when we did this survey, this nationwide survey of people in the United States about the COVID vaccine coming out, and we were hoping it would come out in, you know, November, December of 2020, and we did this survey in June and July, people were just like, oh, we're so scared. This vaccine, we hope a vaccine's going to come out. And, you know, think back to that time. People were really, really frightened, and they're hiding in their houses. So, and they were also really upset, and we were starting to get some protests in the streets, and there were political divisions developing. So there was a lot of turmoil, too. So we were asking, okay, given that there's all this stuff starting to develop, how much is this flu vaccine behavior going to predict their willingness to get a COVID vaccine? Well, as it turned out, their willingness to get a flu vaccine was kind of a predictor. What we found was that 56% of the people who'd gotten a flu vaccine the previous year basically said, yeah, I'm going to get the COVID vaccine when it comes out. But 56% of the people in our sample said, I think I'm going to get the COVID vaccine. But if they'd gotten a flu shot the previous year, it increased to almost 64%. So they were a little bit more likely to get the COVID vaccine, but it wasn't like they were 100% more likely. They were just a little bit more likely. If they hadn't gotten the flu vaccine, they were a little bit less likely. 47% were willing to get the flu vaccine. But it wasn't like a deal killer either. So it wasn't like getting the flu vaccine or not getting the flu vaccine was you know, the be-all end-all. But what about knowledge? If they had good knowledge based on what people knew at the time, which wasn't very much, well, what about that? Does knowledge predict getting a vaccine? Basically, it doesn't. I mean, we've totally seen that knowledge, if logic could predict your behavior, you know, nobody would be overweight, nobody would be smoking, I mean, all this stuff. So, you know, that's not going to do it either. But what if you put the two things together, knowledge and getting a flu shot? Shouldn't that do it? That should be like gangbusters. So we looked at that, and Bruce is the one who can really tell you how that worked. So I think we should probably turn it over to Bruce to explain knowledge plus previous behavior. Shouldn't that predict the flu to getting the vaccine?
I like that you've combined multiple elements, and that makes it more complex. And then we bring in Bruce Austin, the man who can dissect the complexities.
He's the one who's got to explain that
Bruce,
part.
Explain it so that I can understand, because if I can understand it, then I think most people can understand it.
Well, if I can share my screen to just show the theoretical model that Erica came up with. So you can see the theoretical model at this point?
I sure can.
So this is the model that Erica came up with. And the fact that, as she was saying, she had this idea that knowledge and the history of getting a flu shot acted together somehow on their intention to get the COVID-19 vaccine.
And I like that it does say right there, previous behavior is not enough, because you may, 64% may get the, or intend to get the vaccine. That's 36% that's not, right? So I like you combined this.
Yes, exactly. And so she theorized that there was this interaction effect going on between those who received a flu shot and those who didn't, and how knowledge factored into that. And so I'll just continue to the next screen I was going to show. So the typical relationship between like knowledge and some other factor like vaccine intention, you might expect to have a single relationship as represented by this line. So in the flu shot group, we could see that as knowledge increased, then an individual's intention to get the COVID-19 vaccine also increased. That's the upward slant of this line. But when we looked at the no flu shot folks, they had a very different relationship. Their knowledge level had a very different relationship with their intention to get a vaccine. As their knowledge level increased, their intention to get the COVID-19 vaccine decreased. And this is based on knowledge as it was in 2020. And so one of the interesting things that we would like to do with another wave of this survey is to update those knowledge factors, those knowledge questions, and see if we get a similar relationship between those who did or didn't get the COVID-19 vaccine. How does knowledge, now that we historically know who got the vaccine and who didn't, how do these relationships exist among those two groups of folks?
Bruce, could you tell me, you know, in terms of demographics for who the survey went to, I mean, what kind of numbers are we looking at? You know, who was polled, and what can we ascertain based on, you know, the response rate and so on and so forth in terms of the accuracy, I don't know, validity?
Well, we used a Qualtrics panel. So a panel of folks who were recruited by Qualtrics to basically do surveys. And I've often been skeptical of that kind of recruitment because it's not a random sample. You want a sample of people that represent your population. And in our case, our population is the national population. And so it should be representative of all genders, races, ethnicities, that sort of thing. So we worked with Qualtrics to try to make sure that we got those representative proportions of a lot of different groups in our responses, and so we felt that the demographics in our sample ended up close enough to the national picture, the population, that we could make inferences back from our statistics back to the population of the whole. We're confident that these effects that we've seen exist out in the population as a whole.
These are always those bits of research that I find, like, it's incredibly interesting. And then I always have the question, and now what, right? So we know something, we know that, you know, that there's no one thing that I guess dictates somebody, you know, moving toward a vaccine. You know, do we need to talk different kinds of public policies with this? Do we need to talk about additional advertisement, promotions, you know, outreach, you know, all those things, of course, you know, what can we learn from this? And then the next question, because you alluded to this, are we going to redo this again? If, you know, if time and or money allows, to see where are we at now, 2 years later? Because obviously in 2020, things were a moving target. People didn't know what they didn't know. You know, what's the next step, I guess?
Yeah. Well, yeah, this really was early on, and positions have sure hardened since then. And I'd like to mention that other authors on this paper included Porsmita Bora from the College of Communication, who's done a lot of research on vaccines and is on a major study right now with some colleagues from the University of Wisconsin on disinformation and how can you try to intervene to try to fix people's biases about believing disinformation. And also Sterling McPherson out of the College of Medicine, who's doing a lot of great work. And we'd all love to continue to do this work. And although he's not an author on this paper, Ofer Amram is part of our research team. And he's been helping us with drawing some of these samples and looking at people who are at risk in different areas of the country, partly because of where they live and their access to health care. And we also are thinking about access to information as one of those risk factors. And one of the things that's really important is in terms of their access to information, there are news deserts. And as I talked about, people who are ready to take advantage of people in terms of their difficulty with media literacy. In these news deserts, there are organizations that will pretend to be a local news organization, but they really aren't. And they are taking advantage of people who don't have good access to the internet, and they're making use of radio news and all of these kinds of things, and really taking advantage of people. And so, you know, if you saw that model that Bruce put up on the screen, previous knowledge and previous behavior only went so far to predict people's future behavior. Media literacy and trust of experts, trust of medical experts, and local health experts really made the difference. And, you know, WSU has extension to do outreach. Extension experts exist all around the country. We're working with extension experts all around the country right now to help them develop even better skills than they already have in terms of science media literacy and partnering with their local science and health experts to do outreach around vaccination. This is really, really, really important. Helping people to get access to good information, to develop their trust of local experts for science and health is critically important. And as people over the years, Gallup has been doing surveys about who people trust. People trust national experts less and less. They trust politicians, people who serve in the government less and less. They trust each other less and less, but the people they trust the most still are medical professionals. And they even trust them less than they used to, but the people they tend to trust the most are people in their local communities and their medical professionals. So if they can partner to do outreach, that's really where there's some hope, and our study really reinforces that. So media literacy and those trusted local professionals.
You know, even in places, and Erica, this is, you know, your field as well within the Murrow College, that you may call a media desert, right? Sometimes there are a lot of rural places that they're not deserts. They do get media, but because content is so expensive, building content is so expensive, a lot of these, let's just say, small town radio stations, rural radio stations, it's far cheaper for them to syndicate programming that is coming from one political ideology.
Exactly.
And that's what people hear. So, but that kind of leads me to a question for Bruce then with some of the numbers. I mean, even though this is a national, like represented, you know, across different demographics, are we able to parse that data and show that that here are the numbers like for people living in a rural community versus an urban community in the north versus the south, so on and so forth? Or is that something we look at it at maybe a next go round?
Well, having more numbers is always better, having a larger sample. And our sample size is about 1,200, which is not bad. That's pretty respectable. One of our sampling specifications was to make sure that we got individuals from different regions of the country. So the South, the North, the Northwest, to maintain that, to build that representativeness back to the population. And so we can parse that down to a certain extent, but if you parse down too much and you end up with too few people in these individual cells that you're trying to think about, then your information gets pretty shaky. So ideally, yeah. And we did weight the sample to make sure that we had our proportions as close to the national proportions as possible. But again, you don't want to do too much weighting. You don't want to copy the same individuals over and over again in order to increase the whatever group you're trying to have them represent. So you want a large enough sample and a representative enough sample. And I think that it would be nice on our third wave of this survey to perhaps head in that direction with a few more hundred.
Well, both of you, this is, I think, really enlightening research, and certainly it leaves us, it has whetted the appetite, I guess I should say, and leaves us wanting to know even more. I really hope that this can gain some more steam and maybe some further research. But for now, on one hand, I'm not surprised, but on another hand, it's fairly enlightening and shockingly scary. Maybe an indication of our society sometimes, but any last words from either of you before we cut off?
Well, thank you for having us, and always, you know, check your sources and look carefully at the content. Make sure it's up to date. And
thank you for mentioning up to date, because the research does evolve, especially with something new like COVID-19. Bruce, any last words?
That's true. Yeah. That's true. We're always learning more.
Trust the science.
Oh. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks
both very much. Yeah,
yes,
Bruce,
thank you,
Erica,
very much.
It was a pleasure having you on, and I appreciate you joining me for collaborative research. And just so you know, this is how collaborative is I'm doing this video podcast, and then the Murrow College is doing a written story about this. So we're even collaborating on the communications aspect of it. So College of Ed and Murrow College, Ed and Murrow have combined. What do you know?
Yes.
So there you go. All right. Thank you very
awesome.
much, Dr. Austin.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining me on Zoomed In.